Hello, welcome to Leaving Erinsborough, the Neighbours Rewatch podcast from the very beginning. I'm Sarah Gibbs. I'm a writer of many, many things, including a book called Drama Queen. You can buy it, and please do, because I like it when people do that.
And I'm Rachel Krieger, a longtime Neighbours watcher and lover, stand-up comedian, and very busy preparing for this year's Edinburgh Fringe, where I'll be performing my new show, Rachel Krieger, Ultimate Jewish Mother, which I completely am.
Yes, you absolutely are. And we love it. We love it. Also, I like Neighbours. Buy my book
that.
And I like Neighbours.
I feel like I never Neighbours remember to promote myself on anything. That's the most proactive promotion I've ever done. In fact, I was saying to another comedian the other day, you know, when you do spots during the Edinburgh Fringe, you need to say to people at the end, and you can see me at 10 o'clock at whatever. And I don't think in my life, or let's say in my experience of going to the Edinburgh Festival of many, many years, I've ever remembered to do that myself. So, yeah, a little self-promotion there. I hope you don't mind.
Well, there we go. We've got to fill the time somehow, because this month's fortnights, I keep forgetting what we're doing here, block of episodes were a snooze fest. We keep listening, because I'm sure we'll say funny things about it. But it was a dud of a couple of weeks on Neighbours. What happened?
Very few things that happened. Like normally, as you're probably all aware if you listen regularly, I have about like 9 million pages of very intricate notes about the tiniest of details. And Sarah has like pages and pages of notes about the big picture. And I have just under 1 page of notes. And it's only really a full page because 2 lines of it are written in capital letters.
1.5 pages here, I've just checked. It's so, you know, don't get too comfortable. You can see how long the episode is based on, you know, the thing that you're looking at.
Yeah,
your phone.
It has got a revisiting of and I'm saying this is a sort of trigger warning, a revisiting of not very contemporary views on sexual assault in terms of jokes and comments that people make. And the last episode we talked about that in a lot of depth, and I just thought to myself afterwards, it's a fascinating little window actually onto what people were thinking and how people were speaking about these sort of subjects back then, because it's a long time ago now. I mean,
oh yeah, I mean, if I keep thinking, no, it's only like 20 years ago. I'm in my 20s, but I am not.
No, do you exist yet? 37 years ago, whenever it was, 90s.
No, I do not. No. I've got another year to bake.
Right,
so.
You're just a twinkle in the eyes of Harold Bishop in the sky.
That is right. There's a lot of regressive crap going. I say regressive, like I don't even know if it was regressive at the time. The stuff about women working seems straight out of the 1950s, but we'll get there. Let's start with wrapping up a storyline that we touched on last time, which is Helen, Madge and Douglas. Gone too soon.
It's a miraculous story of someone finding someone off a terrible picture.
Helen not giving him much to go on at all. So last time I was confused because the private investigator warned Douglas that Helen knew where he was and then asked for money to not tell her. And this fortnight I'm confused because it turns out he was in on the whole thing and that was part of the plan, but I don't understand how or why.
Because Helen and Madge constructed this plan like it was an old black and white thriller, and so therefore it had to be unnecessarily complicated. And also they wanted to make sure that he wanted extra money, you know, that Douglas would want the extra money, so therefore he'd have to have the £500 to pay off Mr. Rawlings. So I hope everyone's following this, right? Mr. Rawlings, if you weren't listening to the last one, Mr. Rawlings, the, how should we call it? Private investigator, TM, imagine a little trademark symbol in it. He suddenly turned up at the hotel where Madge was kind of stalking Douglas and said he'll tell Helen that he's seen Douglas if he doesn't pay him $500. I was going to say pounds, but pretty sure it was dollars. And so then Douglas suddenly desperately needed to get that money. So it kind of avoided him absconding before he got his hands on Madge's pretendy diamonds.
Yes. I also don't understand. I would have thought that would make him more likely to abscond. Like, that's what I didn't understand.
Because he needs the diamonds.
In order to abscond.
In order to pay off Mr. just... Rawlings and leave the country. But yeah, what I don't get about it is that he has already got Helen's $50,000, hasn't he? Imagine being able to buy a house for $50,000 now. Like, I bet you can't. But anyway.
No, you very much cannot. maybe like, I don't know, some border town with Scotland up north where like a studio flat. So like I think there's somewhere you could probably still buy something.
Maybe a shed. But what I found most bizarre about this whole story is that the exchange takes place, it seems, in random woodland. Now, they've had every conversation, Madge and Douglas, in, you know, the restaurant with that same couple sitting at the table behind them. And now when they're going to exchange the very valuable jewels for very valuable money, they have to meet in a kind of forest, and that makes no sense at all, other than to have Helen lurking behind a bush like the clown from It. So that's what I felt she was like. She sort of slid forward like Homer in The Simpsons sliding back into the hedge. She kind of slid forward at the end and grabbed Douglas's arm, and he, for some reason, wasn't strong enough to shake off this, like, 9,000-year-old woman and make a run for it. And they have their confrontation, which I felt was deeply unnecessary.
No, the whole thing just... So, first of all, Max nearly blows the whole thing by being Max. So he sees Douglas and he's like... He goes into full sort of Max and...
Oh, you bludger! I can't do... Sorry to any Australians.
But this is my favourite kind of Max. It's like well-meaning oaf Max.
Yeah.
And then he's like very worried about the women's safety, which like actually I think is a fair concern, because they're meeting him in the woods for some reason alone and telling him that they screwed him out of a lot of money. I don't wish to victim blame, but that feels like a risk.
It does feel like a risk. But also, I actually thought, you know, in the redemption story of Max, this is another lovely point, because he and Madge fight like cat and cat, really, not or dog and dog. They're not really that different in terms of the way they nudge at each other, other than, you know, she uses longer words. But he was very sweet in his protectiveness of her.
Yeah, I think so. It didn't feel, you know, it didn't feel sort of Neanderthalish like some other stuff has felt in this show. I have some questions.
Ask.
So Douglas hands over the cash to Madge. Madge glances into the envelope, and that's enough for her. Like, if that were me, I'd be like, I would take that shit out and count it.
What, in a forest, like, on a tree stump?
I don't know. Why would you trust that this con man? It didn't just put a bundle of paper or Monopoly money or whatever wrapped in a couple of 50s. Like, why would you glance and be like, yep, this all seems to be in order. How, like, that seems naive. I would have counted it at least before confronting him and being smug.
Yeah, fair.
I wouldn't have confronted him alone in the bushes. And I would also like to know, does Madge at least get a cut? Or should she just give Helen... Does she at least get a commission on this?
There's no mention, but Helen did pay her expenses for when she visited temporarily the expensive hotel where she didn't stay over or take advantage of anything apart from the dinners. So
yeah, that seems like a short thrift, really, doesn't it?
She had an exciting time. She got to be part of an adventure. I mean, what she's done it for, and this is industry speak, is exposure. Hasn't she? She's done it for the exposure, because we're all talking about her now, aren't we? I bet her socials have just rocketed up, Madge. Like, she's got more followers on Insta than she could ever possibly imagine. She's a TikTok star. That's what she's... It's the whole story. But it's very sweet. It's very silly. But yeah, I agree with you. They're not looking at the notes. And he barely glances at the jewels, I'll be honest. He doesn't get his loop out again and check every single one of them. He just has a little look. He thought, oh, they look shiny. We'll have them.
Yeah.
And that's it. It's a lot of trust going on, considering it's people ripping each other off. She's ripping off her husband in the storyline. You know, like, he shouldn't really be trusting her.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, you're right. If she's to be believed, then she is untrustworthy, which is a weird sentence.
Yeah. Well, there you go. That's the strange dynamic of the story. But they are very... I think their excitement about having pulled this off it's gorgeous. The Thelma and Louise-ness of it is really, it's really sweet. And
I want to be in their girl gang, but I want to be in charge of the accounts because I don't trust Helen.
And also I want to be in charge of the attitudes to other people because they're also quite often a little bit questionable.
Yeah.
Having said that, someone, I'm just going to double check the name from our group. Someone clarified something that I said last time, and I think it's only fair to mention about Madge's comment about being black, white, or brindle.
Yes.
And I'm just trying to find where the person put the comment.
It was a book, wasn't it?
It was the title of a book. And I thought that was a really good point. Because at the end of the day, we're not experts. We're just fans. And there are people who are equal fans and sometimes more expert in their knowledge than us in our group, which is what makes this whole thing just absolutely lovely. But I'm still hunting to find that comment. I just thought that was really nice that the person clarified and explained it in such a nice way. So it was Jonathan. Thank you very much for your comment. Regarding the black, white or brindle thing, not 100% sure, but I'm guessing it's referencing the Aboriginal First Nation people of Australia in reference to a noted activist, Ken Brindle. In 1988, a book was published called Black, White or Brindle, Race in Rural Australia. Okay, it's 2 years after that comment, but presumably the book or comments about it existed. Otherwise, it wouldn't have had that title, would it, Jonathan? I guess that's what you're saying. Yeah. So I'm guessing that maybe this was connected. Sorry for the stumbling, I'm dyslexic. But yeah, great comment, and thank you very much. Really interesting and relevant. Thank you for sharing.
Nice. Yes, absolutely. So yeah, that's always, we if you know something that we don't, please tell us. Yeah. We are not precious at all.
Doesn't like have to be about cereal, but it can be.
No. Yeah. It often seems anything you know about Coco Pops, I want to know. So moving on to Des and Daphne, just there isn't really much to say except Des is still pining after Daphne, and he's veering between like what I would call conspicuously manipulative self-pity and angrily berating her for being carjacked. Like, it's a weird flex, isn't it? It's a sort of weird yo-yo thing going on.
I found something interesting in this. I mean, it's a low bar, but Des's house is a reflection on his relationship with Deirdre. This is would be my thesis if I was doing a PhD. That's not going to happen. I mean, the PhD, I could write about this. Des's house, now he's sharing with Zoe, looks like a house share. It stopped looking like he's living with his mum because Daphne is not there doing all the cooking, doing all the cleaning, doing all his ironing, doing up his tie in the morning, giving him wheaten toast or whatever it is she gives him, which she was doing long before they got together, if we all remember. But now he lives with Zoe, who doesn't look after him like that. So if either of them put something down, it doesn't get moved unless one of them moves it. And it now looks like a proper house share house where there's rubbish and mess, and they're arguing obviously over who drank the last bit of French champagne or whatever, because that's all anyone drinks in Ramsey Street at the moment. But I sort of found that quite reassuring that the house is messy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, your female housemates are not your mother.
No.
That's just advice for everyone.
Deirdre set quite a challenging example by... And I have to say, I am a little bit
who
like
who is Deirdre?
That. Deirdre? Daphne. I've called her Deirdre twice, I think, because... I've written Deirdre. Do you know what? That's so weird, because I was thinking about Coronation Street at the beginning of this.
There we go.
I don't want to name drop here, but one of my best friends is in Coronation Street and had messaged me when I started writing my notes. But yeah, I don't know why I've written Deirdre and I've called her Deirdre 20. You all understood I meant Daphne. That's so weird. Mm-hmm. Is Daphne the Deirdre Barlow of Ramsey Street? Discuss.
That's the next topic of discussion in our Facebook group, Leaving Erinsborough. You can join, it's private, and no one will ever know what you get up to in there.
This is true. So what I'm saying is that Daphne did all that stuff for Des, and it's not normal. But I was thinking that when I share flats, which I got married very young, so I didn't really do flat shares and stuff before that. I did 1 year away and then came back, got married. It's one of those things, not a cult thing, just, you know, wanted to. And when I've been in sort of shared accommodation, and since then, like touring or performing at festivals and stuff, I do Jewish mother everybody. So I kind of feel like Daphne took it to a level which is very extreme in terms of looking after the people she lives with. But I do cook for everyone, and I do clear up the kitchen and stuff when it's messy because I don't like it.
Oh, I'm the worst housemate in the world. I'm the one that everyone's like, could you just like pick up your crap off the floor?
Yeah.
But that'll be the autism. Let's blame the autism.
I mean, at home, I'm not so neurotic about it at home. But when I'm away with people, I always feel like, oh, you know, I want to make them happy and comfortable and feel so. Yeah. Why don't I feel like that about my family? That's really weird. I understand Deirdre, as we're now going to call her, to an extent, wanting to always nest in wherever she's living and look after everyone. But I'm quite comforted by the fact that Des is now in a situation where he can appreciate that a bit, because I felt like he really took it for granted. Having said that, he doesn't seem to notice.
No, because I think it's supposed to be like representative of his depressed state of mind that he's living in squalor.
I think, honestly, I feel like it's somebody's essay. I'd love to read the essay exploring Des and his housemates and his state of mind. We had a person, this is the thinness of this fortnight, isn't it, that we're digressing so much, but I used to work in a pupil referral unit. So that's a place for young people who've been kicked out of school because of their behaviour. And there was a member of staff in that particular unit. I've worked in a few, so it's not going to identify a particular individual now. But there was a member of staff whose hair determined their mood, or the other way around. Like, as in, every morning we would have a briefing, and me and my lovely colleague, who I'm still friends with, we used to look at her hair to know how the day was going to go. Because if it was like super fluffy and out there, her behaviour would be like that. And if it was really kind of quaffered, then she would be kind of together, and the students she'd be looking after would have a completely different day. So we knew when we have to be on guard for young people need to be rescued from that classroom, because like her mood level would be quite extreme. And it was really interesting. Yeah, her hair. So
there you go. Her hair, Des's house. Speaking of young people needing rescuing.
Yeah.
Little content warning on this one, for domestic violence. So if that's tricky for you, you might want to skip ahead a little bit. But Mike and his horrible dad and his complicated, let's call her mother. So we see Mike's family for the first time. We actually see his home life rather than him just showing up with bruises. And it's actually a very like well-to-do household. They're quite, you know, it's one of those families where like you wouldn't know from the outside that anything was wrong. They, you know, kind of keeping up appearances.
They have doilies and things, and they have are they called antimacassars? I never know how you pronounce it. And have things on the back of the chairs to make it look posh.
Yeah, and it's what, like, basically Mike is there to protect his mum, who is, you know, she's a domestic abuse victim, and she's very downtrodden. And there's the added complication of her being an enabler of the abuse that Mike gets from his dad.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, she is both victim and perpetrator in a way, because she's sort of, you know, she's hushing Mike up and not backing him up and kind of gaslighting him and joining, you know, and it's coming from a place of fear and being abused and controlled, but it's really upsetting.
Yeah, so I think it's not an uncommon dynamic, unfortunately, in that situation. And they do seem to be slightly older parents, so we don't know how long they might have been waiting to have this child, and so therefore how entrenched those behaviours got before he came along, or when it kicked off. We don't really know. I mean, we don't get any of the background details of how this came to be, but the dad is very uncomfortable, and they do have a big it's not a fight scene, is it, if it's one person doing all the fighting, but with a dramatic slap and fall, which I thought was done quite well.
We did get a funny unintentionally funny neighbors moment where he shows up at the coffee shop, tells Daphne, "It's my dad. I think I've killed him."
Yeah.
Neighbors.
Oh, there's two of those in this lot. Yeah, yeah. That was one. The cheerful song, "I might have killed my dad." And then there's another one coming up a bit later. But I thought that was, if this was a sort of program which was very analytical and realistic and, you know, looked at family dynamics in a deep way, then that would have been an interesting thing because of Danny's fear for having killed his dad. It's a very telling thing that kids on the whole, there's a level at which they love their parents, however terrible their parents are. And
yeah,
it made me wonder if one of the writers of this storyline did have some kind of knowledge of this subject. Because there are elements of it, you know, in terms of the family dynamic. Having worked as a social worker for a really long time and a therapist, there are elements of the family dynamic that are strangely quite accurate compared to some of the other takes we've had on difficult relationships, let's say like Maria and everything about her.
Yeah, it is very realistic. It's very true to life.
Mm. Yeah,
Unlike certain other things, but this feels, you know, like it's sort of odd with neighbors because on the one hand you have these like ludicrous guerrilla carjackings, and then you have these very close to the bone abuse storylines where it, you know, it was actually quite a slow burn, and it feels like how it would play out.
Yeah.
But Mike, with Daphne's help, gets out of the situation, and Clive's help unexpectedly.
Clive, the surprising medical expert.
Yeah, we're seeing hints of Clive, the future doctor here.
He says contusions, I believe.
Yeah, he watches a lot of ER.
But I'm very unclear about whether he's already a doctor and not practicing, or whether he's a medical student who does gorillograms on the side, or like, what is his deal, is my question.
It's not clear, is it? I guess we'll find out. But he does, if he's a medical student, he doesn't seem to, you know, it's a really intense course.
Yeah.
I'm putting my money on he was a medical student and dropped out and that he'll go back. Yeah. That's what I think is going to happen. But I don't know that. That's just my guess.
I can't remember. So, yeah, I can't.
All the surprise. What's next? Oh, Rosemary and the Robinsons.
Mm-hmm.
Hey.
It's confused me a little bit because I'd originally, before I started doing the podcast with you, I'd watched a bit forward of this, and I couldn't remember at the beginning of this that we hadn't met Rosemary before, like that this was the introduction of her. So Rosemary, Helen's adopted daughter, who they keep calling her adopted daughter at every possible moment to make sure we're clear that she's adopted. Everybody hates her. And I can't work out why. Helen's the only person who really likes her. And she doesn't seem, they sort of make out she's a big businesswoman, so she's very cold and tough. But actually, she seems quite nice and reasonable. She's just like a modern feminist woman who has a business. So
it's misogyny. It's pure misogyny.
Even, she had some particular specific deal with Paul, which I guess you're about to talk about. But even Jim, you know, reasonable Jim, and I use that term with some advisement, I think, over the last few months, he seems to not like for no reason. She's not done anything to him or anyone else. All she's done is been a loving sister to his late wife and daughter to his mother-in-law / mother / partner when necessary.
And she threatens him, like just the idea of her. He doesn't like working women. He's got all these mummy issues about it. Mm. He doesn't think he low-key thinks a woman's place is in the kitchen and at home. Mm. He pretends he doesn't, but he does. Like, he's the worst kind of misogynist because he's wrapping it up in this veneer of progressive respectability, and it's nonsense. It's not how he really feels.
Yeah.
And it seeped into even like Scott, who until recently, old Scott was championing his grandmother and her career and her choices, and now is having tantrums at the idea of Helen having any kind of career.
It's whiny awful. Scott, isn't he, this one?
I do not like new Scott.
No.
I do not like new Scott. I don't care how Jason Donovan he is. And I will say it in the face. I do not like him. I am not warming to him. I miss old Scott. I don't like this weird Scott with a new head and a whiny attitude. I don't like how rapey he is. I don't like how... I don't like anything about him. Anyway, so Helen's adopted daughter.
To be absolutely clear.
God forbid she feel like part of the family for any meaningful stretch of time. Mm. Comes to town. We hear a lot from the Robinson men about how she's an aggressive and pushy woman. Read successful.
Yeah.
Paul calls her a bitch.
Yeah, it's hideous. Him and Paul.
And he says the word bitch.
Well, is that worse than any of the things they've alluded to up till now?
I mean, it's mask off, isn't it? Mm. She fired Paul in the past, something to do with an office romance gone wrong for her. It was unclear.
It sounds like she was having some kind of relationship with someone in the office and Paul found out about it and then it came to light and then he did something. But it does sound like Paul did something. Like he did. She didn't fire him for no reason. He was just decided to blame it on the fact that her relationship had broken down with the office person. It got very complicated. And to be honest, it wasn't interesting enough to pay that much attention to. Isn't that a terrible thing to say? But Paul, there's a tendency for Paul's character to get very one-dimensional. Like every so often something will happen that will bring a bit of nuance and then he becomes interesting again. You know, like for example, if we go forward to, you know, recent times, when the Tanaka twins turn up, you know, then you see another side to him in terms of acknowledging these kids and regrets and whatever. And then before and after that, he flatlines quite a lot as just miserable, mean, old businessman Paul. And I think we're seeing that now in this, that he's one note, and then something will happen that will give him a little something to play with, and then he'll go back to... And that's the way the character's been developed. That's not particularly, I think, on his acting or anything.
No, he's doing the best with what he has. So Rosemary arrives and everyone's pissed off with her because she points out that women have rights and feelings and she asks them to do a little bit of housework and they are outraged that they have to help Helen. They are so mad about it.
I think it might be because she's wearing clothes like she's just walked out of Dallas. you know, massive jackets with huge amounts of shoulder padding, and they find that very intimidating.
Yep. Sharp elbows, pointy shoulders, love it. Icon. So Nikki is still there for some reason. Danny has a crush on her and he's doing that thing. Have you ever seen the episode of The Simpsons where Bart falls in love with the Reverend's daughter?
I have indeed seen that episode.
He's doing that sort of, you know, like showing up with his hair all like, you know, like cosplaying as a functioning adult and like being very polite to all the grown-ups and
talking about the bank, being a banker. He mentions being a banker a lot. Well, but you know, Nikki's into that. I don't think that's a stupid idea. I think if you were going to impress her, that's the way to do it. I thought that was very sweet, and also like Nikki does like him as well, but they're being very teenagey about it, which is fair because they are teenagers and misunderstanding each other. So like she invites him to the cinema and then he goes, yeah, Scott, do you want to come to the cinema? Like, everyone, should we all go to the cinema together? And it reminds me of when I was first dating my lovely husband Mark. Because we've been friends for years and years and loads of people predicted we'd get together and they were very Harry and Sally about us and it was really annoying. When we actually did get together, we didn't want to tell anyone because we didn't want, A, everyone's smugness and B, everybody's eyes on everything we did so that they, you know, and expectations. We needed to work this out if it was going to happen by ourselves. And that did mean that on a number of our early dates, other people were like, where are you off to? Oh, the cinema. Yeah, we'll come. And we went on a lot of kind of thruppily dates where people came with us because they thought it was just Mark and Rachel hanging out. No, they just thought it was us like doing normal friends hanging out things.
Yeah.
And they didn't realise that. In fact, on this occasion, Mabel wanted to sit and hold hands in the cinema, but we couldn't because people sat in between us and such like. So, yeah, they had no idea.
That's terrible.
It was what it was.
Oh, dear. That's very funny. He cock blocks himself basically.
Yeah.
And And but he's the only one who is respectful of Rosemary, who's interested in her experience, who, you know, he's networking, he's hustling.
What he's doing is he's dressing for the job he wants, isn't he, in every way. And he's quite desperate for, I mean, Ashley, I'm really sorry, because I meant to start off the beginning of the podcast. I had a plan. You know, you have a plan of exactly what you're going to say in a situation, but you don't write it in the right place of your notes, so you don't remember. So when you introduced yourself, I was going to reply with, sorry, I'm too busy for this today because it's my turn to run the Daniels Corporation. Because a big through line of this fortnight, once Rosemary turns up, is about who's going to run the Australian branch of the Rosemary Daniels Corporation. And Danny, is who's worked in a bank for about half an hour, maybe an hour. he's a school leaver, like, as in he's left after, I guess, GCSEs, not A levels, because he didn't stay on to the end of school. And now he's going to run, or in his mind, he's ready to be the CEO. And I think that's amazing. And I also think it's very male. The kind of males in this show, to think, right, well, I could put myself forward. It's quite an astonishing thing. In fact, I applied for something the other day, and I said, the boys are always so quick to apply when people say they're looking for women. So I thought I'd give this a go the other way around, but I didn't get a response to it. Just having that belief in yourself. I mean, if I had a quarter of the belief in myself that Danny has in himself, I would be very famous by now.
Unstoppable. Yeah, it is there is a sort of a white male entitlement going on. I mean, look, you know, I wish him well. But yeah, Nikki has a boyfriend or date or so. I can't remember his name.
Rich William.
I'm just gonna call him Lord Snootington. whose whole, like, he's just sort of a one note sort of comedy parody character, isn't he?
Yeah.
That, like, women belong in the kitchen and I have servants to do all this. Mm. And I think he's just really there to make Danny look like a viable option, to be honest. Nikki is, like, you know, a feminist and stuff, but apart from when it comes to her boyfriend, and she's like, how dare you be rude to this guy who's demeaning me.
I don't think he's her boyfriend, really. I think he's one of two friends from school who she has sort of, I was going to say groomed, but it's a terrible word now because it has connotations. But in its original meaning of sort of, they're the people that she'd like to be in social settings with because they're wealthy and, you know, speak properly and whatever. So I think they're her, like, aspirational friends.
Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah. She's climbing. And, then Rosemary is going about offering this job to everyone, like I don't know, like she's bought a pack of crisps at the pub. anyone want a bit of job? Anyone want a job?
If she'd only opened them down the centre bit so everyone knew they were sharing ones and not personal ones, it would have all been fine.
Well, there we go. She offers Helen the job first for no apparent reason other than to get her to leave the Robinsons, and she makes that a condition of the job offer.
Yeah.
So then the Robinsons go into full kind of, I would say, coercive control, like, not that extreme, but there is something really controlling about the way that they respond to Helen maybe leaving. Everyone's trying to control Helen.
Mm.
But like Jim going, oh no, we all have to show her that if she stays, we'll briefly pick up after ourselves and then stop doing it the second the danger's part. There's something very manipulative about it. It's very unpleasant. Helen says no to the job. And Scott is a big feminist until he's about to lose his domestic help. Then he has a tantrum. Then she offers it to everyone else on the planet, including Des, for some reason. And then
Least Des is the manager of the local branch of Pacific Bank that is very nearby. But yeah, they drive to it.
The Ramsey Street branch. And then Paul,
it's probably in his garage.
Paul is like, I don't take orders from women. And she's like, perfect.
Yeah, that's
you've got the job.
Like,
what?
I like that she takes him to see the office and it's like some tatty little, it's not even bad, but they make out like it's a tatty little dingy whatever on some estate. And they have this whole conversation about seeing the potential, like all the offices he wants to be in the future, you know, glass and sleek metal and bits of driftwood and whatever, that they're all created by somebody who started off in this horrible dark mahogany laminate office, like where he is now. You know, she's seeing the vision of the future for him. Why is she having to work so hard to convince someone who doesn't like her, is completely untrustworthy, very bad at picking wives, to be the CEO? None of us can understand. Answers on a postcard.
No, it's baffling. Also, Rosemary wants to find her birth mother, probably because everyone keeps reminding her how adopted she is. And Helen reacts in exactly the opposite way that I imagine is probably the right way to react. It's like, oh, you don't love me. That's a kind of response. And she tells Madge that there's some secret about Rosemary's birth mother. I'm struggling to care, but Rosemary wants to meet her birth mother and Helen doesn't want her to.
Yeah, she says, how will she react when it turns out I've known all along who her mother is? And that was a very EastEnders moment. I thought there would be a diff, diff, diff. But there was a little moment with Rosemary cuddling Helen on the couch and telling her that she loved her and everything. And I thought that was nice. That was nice. And Helen does love her.
It is nice. It's just... Yeah, we're gonna have to sit through this adoption storyline now, so I'm not excited about that. Things can surprise you. Anything else about Rosemary while we're on Rosemary?
No, I just put why does everyone hate Rosemary, and then about five lines later it says Rosemary's a bully. But I don't think she really is. I think she's just, especially if she's living in America in like a real man's world, you can kind of understand why she is how she is.
Yeah, there's a difference between assertiveness and bullying, I think, and she's on the right side of it. Danny and the gambling. So forgive me, it was my understanding, based on having known someone who has been in like statistical modeling specifically for gambling, that this is like PhD level stuff, right? This is complicated mathematical stuff. It's not just like you make a computer program and you put some numbers in and doop doop doop. It's like really people study this stuff. So Max's gambling, and Danny has some sort of computer program with some computer nerd friend that tells you which horses are going to win, and there's a whole comedy of errors with Max wins some money and then he wants Danny to bet it, and then Danny plays it safe and doesn't, and all the horses win, and then when he does bet it, he bets it on the wrong horse, but Max doesn't get the message and he thinks that he's won a bunch of money but he hasn't. There's a lot of Max shouting and blaming Danny for all of his poor decisions. Dez is involved somehow.
I don't know. It's interesting because the normalization of gambling in the program it's been an ongoing thing, hasn't it? Because there was the point where Max preferred the idea that Danny was gambling, which was his kind of pretendy excuse, than that he would be working for Clive. Remember? Yeah. So gambling's fine. It's just we're supposed to feel sorry for Max because of this mistake, as opposed to thinking, maybe don't gamble.
Yeah. Well, there we go. Yes, I don't have much else to say about it. Just like I'm not interested in horse racing in life, and I'm not interested in watching imaginary horse racing, and it's just boring. So moving on to what I think is the last storyline, unless I've forgotten something, which is Shane and his stalker, harasser.
Yeah, Beth. That's what I've got the most notes on about everything. That and Pacific Bank. It's a very, very weird twist in that is it really a twist? I don't know. In that Shane's being really quite strongly sexually harassed by Beth.
And relentlessly.
The empathy he gets from his friends is not only non-existent, but it is so victim-blamey. So this is where the content warning, I guess, comes into focus a little bit, because, before any of that, is that Shane waves a can of Foster's at the screen. So clearly this episode was sponsored not by Cocoa Pops, but by Foster's Lager. She essentially gives him a booty call, Shane, you know, calls him in the middle of the night in his house where he lives with his dad and his brother. I put Boo to call for Shane from the Garden Goddess. And then he's really uncomfortable about this relationship. And Paul's advice to him is that you could always scream rape if she touches you in a way you don't like.
These writers, man.
It's really concerning. Clive tells Beth that Shane's getting married to kind of put her off. That doesn't really work.
He gives the full name. He's like, to Daphne Lawrence, her address is. Yeah. Like, what are you doing?
Here's her email. And then the comments when she sort of really starts giving him a hard time, from like Daphne says, or what's the matter? Are you being sexually harassed? And sort of makes
fun of diddums. Him. Yeah,
and,
it's terrible.
Paul makes comments about rape, and one of them says, "Oh, maybe you shouldn't wear shorts when you go around there."
That was Daphne. She's like, "Well, men say that to me, so it's fine." It's like, "Well, no. Think about how it made you feel, Daphne."
Not fine.
And then Shane goes, "That's different." It's like, "Well, no, hold on." You're all wrong. Let's press pause and we're going to have a conversation about why you're all wrong.
Yeah. And also Beth's garden is like the fourth bridge, right? In that they were asked to, I think, build a wall or something at the beginning of this, but they've been working there doing a million other things for weeks and weeks. It feels like for years. They've been working on this garden so that as soon as they finish one thing, they've got to start another one. And then
it's like Mrs. Forbes's hole, like they took 3 weeks to dig a hole.
Right, exactly. I was trying to think who was Mrs. Forbes, and I remembered it was in this program. It was a big hole. It was a very impressive hole. And then we have this whole incident of her luring him into the shed or the basement or what, or the wine cellar. I think this gets called all those things at one point or another. Locking him in and then telling Clive that he's left early and he's got the bus, and Clive does seem suspicious of all the things he's suspicious of in this situation. Not the fact that this woman who's been sexually harassing his friend has said he's disappeared, it's that Shane might have taken a bus. That's the only thing that he thinks sounds a bit off, but he accepts it. And meanwhile we have Shane trapped in a shed which, I'll be honest, has got a very flimsy door, and I do feel like an ex-athlete could probably kick it down without too much difficulty, especially once he realizes he's not there by accident.
Yeah, the whole thing. So it was baffling. First of all, so there was this back and forth about him being in a relationship with Daphne or him marrying Daphne. He tells her the truth and he's like, no, I was in a relationship with Daphne, but that's over now. Hmm. And then she then goes to see Daphne. And Daphne says, oh, there's nothing between us, which doesn't contradict anything Shane said. And what Shane said was still the truth. Mm. And then Beth is mad because she says Shane lied to her, but he didn't.
No, it was Clive who lied to her. I mean, Shane just kind of went along with her a little bit because he thought she was quite pretty and he wanted to keep his job.
But at that point, he told her the truth. Like, there was no lie. And then she lures him to the basement, locks him in, and I think we are in for something really sinister here. We're in for like a long, you know, because that's really serious. That's really scary behavior. We're in for a long slog here. Like, he's going to be trapped down there for a while. And, you know, we're going to have to see him escape, or like maybe he hurts her in the escape and then no one believes him, or like, God, you know, this could be the start of a whole thing. And like, you know, I was like, this is like disturbing. It's like a thriller, right? And then somehow he sort of gets them both locked in there, or doesn't.
Locked in the flimsy room.
Yeah. And she comes out with some sandwiches. And then she implies that she's laced the sandwiches with some sort of drugs. Mm. And he stops eating them. And then they have a conversation. And she's like, oh, I'm just lonely. And he's like, oh, why don't you get a hobby or a job? And she's like, okay.
I've got one. I lock people in cellars.
She's like, oh, I didn't think of that. All right, I'll let you go. And it's like, they just have a reasonable conversation and she lets him out. And it's like, it's sort of like, what am I meant to feel watching this? What is this?
Yeah, I think you're meant to feel that if you have a reasonable conversation with stalkers, then usually they're fine. They're just a bit lonely and it's fine.
Yeah. It was all a big misunderstanding.
It's such a weird message. But anyway, but he more or less poodles off whistling. And
it's almost played for laughs.
That's the end of that.
The way the way that she goes, you know, oh, well, the sandwiches weren't really laced. I just wanted to scare you.
Yeah.
And I've had the key all along. Ha ha ha. What is this tone?
Do you think it's the inspiration for the film Saw? I don't know if that's a spoiler.
Someone saw it and thought, I can do better than this.
Yeah. I can take all the elements of that and I can make it actually scary. But in a way, this is more scary because there you expect to be a bit horrified. And in this incident, you don't know what to think.
Yeah. Have I missed anything?
Well, a few little things. We talked about Scott and his, but we didn't talk about the fact his terrible acting when he was doing Cleopatra, an extra of Cleopatra. And I imagine that he was told, do it really badly, because if it wasn't a director's choice, then it's amazing he ever got the role. And he's got a very changeable attitude to school, which you did mention, but I thought that was interesting. We missed just talking about Max hating being stropped at by his kids and by Madge, and then Danny joining in and his lovely comment, "That's right, son, take over the whipping, her arm's getting tired," which I thought was a beautiful Maxism. Quick question, why is everyone always in Pacific Bank? Do they have nowhere else to go? And
it's a cool hangout spot for teens.
But the real thing that I'm astonished, there's two things I'm sure you missed out, is one, why does everyone wear tabards when they do anything in their house? I don't really understand. Have I mentioned it before? But the tabard thing's bothering me. And also, Des's brilliant poetry when he found out that Zoe was chucking her dregs of champagne into the plant pots. This is Des's poet. This is Des's poem. "Feed your plants on Moe and watch them grow, eh?" Never mind the fact that it's really Moet and watch them grow it. We won't delve into that too much, but I thought that was hilarious when he said that.
Also, missed opportunity to rhyme with Zoe, but okay.
Well, quite right. Yeah, so they could have taken it further, but it did come completely out of nowhere, given that he's not been prone to poems up till this stage. And then, of course, at the end, Max choking to death before the music kicks in.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah. Max chokes to death. Max looks like he's choking to death. And we watch his contorted face, and then it's neighbours.
Perfect.
What a beautiful moment.
Amazing. Who are we kicking out?
Who would you like to kick out? You go first.
I'm going to say Mike's dad.
Okay. Feels
pretty unambiguous this time.
Then I'm also going to say Mike's dad, because last time I didn't say whoever was the bad person and I felt guilty about it afterwards. But if you've got rid of Mike's dad, so you've removed that problem, then I think I might kick out Beth, the abductor stalker. Although in a way she's one of the least boring characters of the fortnight, so maybe I'm doing her a disservice. At least she had a bit of a laugh pretending to make poisonous sandwiches. Like, there's a bit of life to her.
Yeah, yeah. At least she made things interesting. I hope we haven't seen the last of Beth.
Mm. I think that we could have a new thing. Like in EastEnders, I'm sorry to mention it again as a rival soap, that when they want to get rid of people, they go to Manchester or up west. And I think the Rosemary Daniels Corporation should be our room 101 where we send people. So perhaps what's happening this month is that we're sending Mike's dad and Beth to run the Daniels Corporation.
Good idea. Good idea. Someone's got to do it. No one wants to do it.
Rosemary seems to be too busy for reasons none of us know. She's busy finding her real mum, as she keeps saying. I don't like the expression real mum, but yeah.
Real mum, adopted. It's very loaded, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Right. If you want to talk to us, we are on Twitter at Leaving Errands, and we have a private Facebook group, Leaving Errandsborough. Please don't forget to agree to the group rules. And let's hope next time is a more interesting fortnight, because, we'll hopefully have more to say.
I think we've managed to fill a reasonable amount of time with very little, and I think that alone is impressive. But I'm going to have to go now because it's my turn to stand behind the counter at Pacific Bank to have no question about the money I don't have.
See you next time.
Bye.
Leaving Erinsborough was hosted by Sarah Gibbs and Rachel Krieger. This episode was edited by John Gibbs. Our logo is by Hayley Charlesworth. Our theme song was mixed by Graham Rawson. Please don't forget to subscribe, rate and review wherever you get podcasts. Join us next time when we'll be covering episodes 200 to 210.